home of Professor Donald Anderson for a second visit. It is September 23rd, 1991, and Professor Anderson is going to start the evening by telling us a little bit about what he did during WW2.
Well, when I was in graduate school, I was teaching painting, and it had to be specially designed for me because it was called landscape painting, which implied I wasn't competent to do the ordinary stuff. In the middle of the semester of 1941, a teacher died in Duluth State College, which later became a part of the University of Minnesota, a branch, as in Wisconsin. And I went there in the middle of the semester of 1941 to replace this deceased teacher. And the president of the place was a man named Sorensen, Herbert, I think, but he was known as Sandy. He was a socialist. And that, I presume, is why I had been hired, because Lester Longman, the head of, at Iowa, had determined that I was some kind of leftist radical. And I think perhaps that's how he sold me to Sandy Sorensen. Sorensen was a socialist. He had been put in power, or put into the position, by the Farm Labor Party in Minnesota, which was known at that time to be quite radical. And as soon as the Republicans recovered their positions, they got rid of Sandy. Anyway, we spent, the faculty spent the evening of Pearl Harbor at Sorensen's place. And there were a number of tycoons in Duluth who had made lots of money on lumbering and shipping, and they gave a lot of their old mansions to the university there. And he said to me one night, "You know, it's quite proper that these were given to the university, and now the ordinary students have the benefit of it." And so, and I thought Sorensen was rather an ideal person, except that I found out that he gave money to the WCTU and didn't believe in drinking, especially when instructors were not to drink with students. And I got the message right away because I had already been there. But at the end of the year, I was due to go into the Army, and I couldn't leave my wife in that miserable town because nobody paid a living wage. So we went to Washington, D.C., where we had a very great number of friends, and where a woman could get a decent wage to live on while I was in the Army. So we went there in the summer of 1942 and never returned to Duluth. And then I went to work for the ordnance department as an illustrator. I had to learn the stuff on the job because it involved an airbrush. I had to go down to a newspaper, borrow their airbrush, and do a piece in the afternoon to show them I could do it, and then I got hired in the fall of 1942 and stayed there for a year or so, and did a lot of stupid drawings for them with the airbrush, including airships, tanks, everything else you could think of. But then I was due to go into the Army and went in the fall of 1943. And because of my connections in the Pentagon, I was saved from going into the Army, or the Navy rather, and was shipped to Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland to be an aircraft gun mechanic. I don't know why they figured that a college graduate should be an aircraft mechanic. It's beyond imagination. But there I was, and went through basic training and field training in Virginia. The first being 4 weeks, and the second three, I think. And the only notable thing about that was that the outfit was full of New York kids. And there was a number of people, though, from Iowa and Illinois. And all the farm boys knew how to keep their feet from freezing, but the New York young man did not. So we got through field training all right. And the secret of it was to keep your socks dry. Do not, in the morning, put on wet socks, ever. And that is the sole secret of living in the country. All farm boys knew that already. And then after that stint, I was sent to cadre school because I knew how to drill platoons and companies. That was 6 weeks. I had no trouble with that. But there was one thing that I remembered, and that was one of the members was a rather well-known labor leader from New York who was, I think, of Spanish descent. There was no doubt about it. So one day he is drilling a group of people and he says as follows, "Platoon!" And it was as if he had been thumbed out of the game by an umpire because he was gone from that unit for saying that one word. It was because, I think, later, that you couldn't give orders to people who laughed at you. And that just one word was all they had to hear, and he was kicked out. The poor guy. He was probably very competent otherwise. And so this went on for 2.5 years. And then some of the people were getting out of the unit by having enough points or enough time put in to get out. So I was put in with a group of young kids. And they were, I presume, about 18 or 19. And here I was, 30 or 31, and I couldn't stand them. They made so much noise, and I stayed awake all night. I couldn't stand that thing. So I went back to the Pentagon, where I knew a lot of people. And I didn't realize that in the Army, you could shop around for jobs. You could just go to a place, said, "You need such and so," and if they could take you, you'd get orders to move. So I just went down to the Pentagon and got another job in a publishing unit designing histories of the war. And I stayed there in uniform and then stayed there as I exchanged uniforms in 1946 in the spring. and exchanged my uniform for a very loud sports coat. It was a lot of fun. I should remind you, though, that in the Army, when President Roosevelt died, I was walking with a kid from Philadelphia. And when we heard the news, we both wept. Anyway, I got out of the Army and into this unit and stayed there for a year or so, and then wanted to get back into teaching and sent out a word to friends here and there. And I had a friend at Michigan State, and he said, well, you're just a coward. You don't want to go back into teaching until they pay you something. And I said, that's right. At the time, in civil service, I was making $4,800 a year. And I sent out these various messages to friends and got a reply from the University of Wisconsin, who wanted to pay $3,000. So I said, couldn't you make it 32? I could stand the drop from 48 to 32 if you could do it, and they did. I think the reason I got the position was because I had known a fellow named Bill McCloy, who was on the staff here. I had known him at Iowa. He was a diver on a swimming team. Oh, about being a senior when I was a freshman on the swimming team. And so I got to know him, and he was here for a number of years and has a mural in the Historical Society, fourth floor. McCloy was an exceedingly professional person, as that mural will testify to. And so there were a couple of other people on the staff who have a liberal turn of mind, and some of the things I sent them were covers from a magazine that featured Negroes, and I think some of them were persuaded by that I would be somebody who would fit in with them. So I came here in the fall of 1947. And my wife Marjorie stayed in Washington, D.C. until I got a place to move to. When I first got here, I stayed at a place near the square called the Lorraine Hotel. It was one of the chief places to be. Not that that means anything, but it was near the square. And so, a day or so later, I went up into the Capitol building and up into the top of it and took a look at the town. I was astonished and couldn't quite make it out because there were lakes and water and streets running here and there, and I couldn't make any sense out of the town at all. I didn't know whether what being on the east side meant or what the contour of the lakes meant. I didn't know anything about it. But later on, when my wife Marjorie came in with the movers, they took a wrong turn and went out Highway 14 for a while, corrected the mistake, and we were put into a barracks in up near Baraboo. What do you call that
Badger
place?
Badger Village.
It was called Badger Village, and it was, the reason for it was there hadn't been such a sudden influx of students coming back from the war, plus faculty to take care of them, that there wasn't any place in Madison to live. The places were full everywhere. And so we were sent this, must be way above, it's some miles above Sauk City, between Sauk City and Baraboo. And it's a big flat plain, but it's about 40 miles from Madison. And in this place, it was like a barracks. There were two rooms in the place, and one was the kitchen, and the other one was the bedroom and the bathroom, the communal bathroom down the hall. And then it came on in the winter, and it turned out that to get to a 7:45 class, you had to get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and eat something and get ready to go and go into Madison on an unheated bus, which was bad enough. But the worst part was, if you had to go in early, the bus wasn't going to come back until something like 8 o'clock in the evening. And what the hell you were going to do with your time in between was beyond me. Anyway, it was the worst schedule in teaching history. And it was a very hard thing to do. And I thought to myself, here I had this easy job in Washington, D.C., paying a lot more than what I'm getting, and I didn't have to go through this. I lived in a very decent apartment in Washington, D.C., and I just wondered when it was going to come to an end. But in the spring, I met a girl on the street that I had known at Iowa. And she said, there's a new apartment going up over here. Maybe you should go and get on the list, which I did. And by accident or some other reason, I got accepted. So that in the late spring of 1948, we actually got to move into an apartment on the east side. It was quite a nice apartment, too. But, of course, if they paid you $3,200 a year, the apartment was so expensive that it was imperative that my wife go to work again. Which she didn't mind, but that gives you an idea of what the situation was. If you lived in a decent apartment in town, you didn't get paid enough to do it. I should add that the experience of driving back to Badger Village was not quite as bad as it really was. One evening, we were coming back from university, and the bus, it was 14 below zero, and the bus stopped in Middleton and refused to run. So then, we all got out and hitchhiked back up to Baraboo, and I thought some more about how nice it would be to be back in Washington. I hadn't had that hard a time, even in the Army. But at any rate, the teaching began, and we began with secondhand rooms. And I had always been brought up to believe that the University of Wisconsin was very special. And it seemed to me that when I got here, it was rather astonishing because the Department of Art was absolutely nothing. It was run by old people who had methods that went back to some former year, maybe even the Renaissance or before, and they were perfectly without talent. And this was a hard thing to accept too, because it seemed to me that sometimes there was no hope whatever until these old ladies who had been there for years and years hadn't the slightest idea what was going on in terms of the painting scene in Europe and America, and knew nothing about it, nothing about the sculpture that had been happening. And this was very dismal, but there were a few other young people there, and so perhaps we were trying to get along as best we could. We didn't have a vote because you can't vote in those years unless you are an associate professor, although sometimes they skipped a rule and made it an assistant professor who could vote. But anyway, the department turned out to be a haven for sorority girls. And this was appalling because the sorority girls had no intention of going to class ever. And it took a while to figure this out. And it was very systematic, it turned out, as the sorority girls from Maple Bluff or some other place in town had no intention of going to class or learning anything. And maybe it was a toss-up, because if they went to some of the classes, they weren't going to learn anything anyway. But they did not attend class. And at the end of the year, they would approach the teacher and lay on them a very sad story, which had some fictional elements. This and that had happened, and this was a sad tale they would lay on these ladies. And naturally, they got by with it until myself and Dean Meeker and a couple of other people got there and found out what was happening. And it was astonishing that at the end of this time, when they would put these sad tales on these teachers, that it turned out quite often that their mothers would come to the school and seek out the teacher and explain to them this sad tale. And Dean Meeker said that he had some very attractive offers from these matrons. but then I didn't get anything like that, but I think maybe it was because maybe Dean was a better-looking guy. But he swore that these ladies would do anything to get their daughters off the hook. Well, we made short work of this because we began to stick these sorority girls with coming to class and performing like anybody else should. And it took some doing, but we did it. And in a year or two, it was no longer a haven for these people, a refuge to get to the university without doing any work. And so things worked out well for me, except for this this doings in Baraboo. What did you call it?
Badger Village.
Badger Village. And in that, there are the two rooms, so I had to do watercolors on the kitchen table. But immediately, I got very hot. And in 1948, there was a centennial show in Milwaukee. And due to the fact that this was a centennial, the stipend for winning something was greatly enlarged. Where normally it might be $50, there were three prizes for $500 apiece, and I won one of them on a little watercolor. And John Wilde won another one. So we had our picture taken together with another young lady that neither of us knew. But one of the judges was Ben Shahn, a rather well-known Eastern painter. And I met him later, and he said, you know, giving a $500 prize to a little watercolor like that took a lot of nerve, he said, and I wanted to get out of town as quickly as I could. But anyway, that was a really large piece of change and good luck for me. And the same summer, I hit another big prize at the University of state of Illinois, called the Midwestern Annual, and it was I won a purchase prize of $250 for a work that showed one of those hills, stone hills north of Baraboo. And not only was that a large one to win, but it also was reproduced in Art News, so that I had a fairly hot record right off the bat. And the most I got out of it was that later on, it was assumed that since I was doing so well, I was probably neglecting my class. At any rate, during these early years, one of the older teachers was a nice lady by the name of Helen Juan Annan. She was married to a guy named Petey Annan, who was a vulgar character. One time, we were at a party, and Petey Annan, who was a professional landlord, was complaining about his plight as a landlord and his difficulties. Anyway, Petey was at this party complaining about his hardships as a landlord, and I thought that my hardships were caused by people just like Petey, who had refused to let the university build housing units for the new faculty. In fact, in the party, I made the mistake of calling him a liar, and it was a nice thing to do. But anyway, Because of this, and perhaps for other reasons, I was up to be fired at the end of my second year, and it was sort of sad that I didn't think that my liberal friends and the faculty had done enough to stand by me. And I was due to go, but for some reason or other, the dean, John Guy Fowkes, wasn't quite convinced about this. And I think that he called in a person from the art history department named James Watrous, who was not only a historian, but also a practicing artist. And I think that John Guy Fowkes asked Watrous for advice in the matter, and he said that it was happening all over the country that these new faculty were coming in, and you couldn't get rid of all of them, and so you might as well get used. The old people would have to get used to putting up with the new people, and I was saved, I think, by that gesture. And but in my exit from the dean's office, he said, "Why do you have anything to do with P.T. Annan anyway?" He said, "I don't." And I said, "I agree with you there." And we parted company for a while and didn't see one another again for quite a while, at least not on the business of having to exit the place. And things went on, and I began to design things for various parts of the department. And in the summer of, I think it was 1952, I think we invited Ben Shahn, the New York artist, to spend a week on campus, which he did, and I got to know him, as others did too. And he seemed to like my way of working. And there was one interesting episode in that particular trip. And that is, on the steps of the Union, there was a guy set up to photograph a whole bunch of citizens. I don't know who they were, probably 30 or 40, where each row, they were on three or four different steps. And there was when there was a photographer there underneath a cloth to get his stuff in focus and all, Ben Shahn got on the back of the group and stood there very quiet and still, hoping to get his picture in there. And all of a sudden, Santo Zingale said to him, "Ben, you're in the wrong place." And the people in the row turned around, looked at Sean, and said, "Get out of here." So he was very angry with Santo for spoiling this thing. Sean was good at making jokes. He liked to have his picture taken in front of streets named Sean, if there were any. And he liked that kind of a joke, and but Santos had spoiled it for him. And but as a result of his stay there for that week, he invited me to come to New York and spend a week with him. And during that time, he lived in a place called Roosevelt, New Jersey, which was a housing development, I suppose, named for the president. And so he lived across the river in Jersey. But because of this visit, Sean introduced me to a lot of important art directors. There was Bill Golden for CBS, and I was astonished because he's a rather famous art director in New York history, and he had very small quarters and only one or two guys working in there. The reason for it was that all the work he had to do as far as art was concerned was farmed out. That he had a file card, and if he needed a certain kind of thing, he would just call the guy up. And then I was actually sent to the editor, art editor of Fortune, which seems a little insane, but anyway, I spent a half an hour with this guy. And I don't know why Sean would have done this, because the chances of my obtaining work from anybody like that was fairly remote. And he also sent me to CBS Records, which did things in three colors, and I had no technique for that. And he sent me to Harper's, and a guy named Russell Lines, who doubled as a literary editor and as art editor too. And we got along fine, and he appreciated the things I showed him. And also, I was sent to see Bill Golden's wife, whose name was C.P. Pinellas, who ran the art for 17 magazine. It was very popular at the time. I liked that, but I had nothing to show this lady. I just enjoyed the talking to her and so on. But I don't know what Sean had in mind. I think he thought that I was sort of a primitive, as somebody thought of him as a primitive too, in a way. And so he thought that maybe a country primitive would do something in New York. And I didn't have the techniques to obtain employment in these things. But it was a very interesting experience anyway.
I'm going to end the tape on this side and flip it over to the other side.
Should add that one of my early colleagues in the University of Wisconsin was Santo Zingale. Alfred Sessler was another. Both of these people were of a somewhat liberal point of view politically. And Santo was accused of being a member of the Communist Party. And it so happened that he was. But one time, the Milwaukee Police Department had a police wagon tipped over, and they went and picked up Santos and arrested him. But, he said, he sued them, because he said he wasn't there. And he proved it and won the case. In other words, he was guilty every time but that one. And he happened to catch him, and he sued them and won, which was lovely. Alfred Sessler was also accused, although he was a rather timid type of person in comparison to Santo. But anyway, he was accused of being a communist also, and it turned out later that he had been, for he said, a month or two. He was much too timid a person to have stuck with him, or to, he was too private a person to have submerged his personality into a group action thing. He didn't like it, and he didn't like anything like that either. So that if he had been a member, he shortly resigned and wasn't a part of it. But in the early years, the president of the place, was a person from Ag School, a gentleman from Virginia. What was his name?
E.B. Fred.
It was E.B. Fred. And he was, apparently, I'd seen him a few times, and it gave me the impression that he didn't know anything about the art department and never would. And this is probably a good assessment. He didn't know the connection between the art department and the extension. And he said to me, "Who is this James Schwalbach in extension anyway?" So he really didn't know the intimate connections of the various parts of the university. But the interesting thing was that a lot of people were oppressing. There were newspapers and other radio commentators in Milwaukee who were constantly telling about the communists harbored by the university in the person of Santo Zingale and Al Sessler. I don't know why this came to a point, but apparently it did at one time. And this old Virginia gentleman decided to bring the thing to a point, invited the newspaper commentators and radio commentators in Milwaukee into his office together with Zingale and heard them out. And at the end of the thing, he said, "That is the end of it." And neither Zingale or Sessler were ever bothered again, which shows something about the person of E.B. Fred, good person. On the other hand, he wasn't so liberal about any kind of suggestion of sexual doings, because if he had found out, and I know I could name one or two cases where the faculty was involved with sexual conduct with students, they were fired right then. This happened with a student, female student that I knew, and the professor was simply fired. And That was that. So although E.B. Fred, I never thought, was a great president in terms of getting things done for the university, he was of the proper school for, in terms of integrity of thought and that sort of thing. Well, anyway, personally, in 1952, in the meanwhile, the Gimbels competition in Milwaukee began to give large sums of money to artists for doing their thing for Gimbels, and a man named Charles Zadoff was the brains behind this. And so they had several competitions, and there were thousands of dollars available, and so this money was spread out among the artists of Wisconsin, and if we hit it once in a while, you know, it was a good payday. And in 1952, I guess, I got one of these prizes. We won something around here almost every year. And I certainly got my share three or four times. But in 1952, Life magazine did a story on Zadoff and his artistic enterprises with the Wisconsin artists, and reproduced one of my paintings in the largest size I'd ever seen in Life magazine. It ran over both pages. This is it. And it was perfectly astonishing to see one's work at that size reproduced in a great magazine. So on seeing this, I very carefully rehearsed something about my good fortune. I was sure that many people would be asking me about it. And so I rehearsed this modest proposal, saying that I had got lucky and all this and that. And it turned out that in the subsequent week, not one person asked me about this thing at all and never even mentioned it. I thought, while fame is fleeting and practically non-existent, and I'm sure more people in other towns noticed it, but nobody around here did. And then about 1959, I think it was, Harper's was doing a story on the University of Wisconsin, written by a citizen named Boroff. I had never heard of him, and I still don't know what his connections were, but he had a contract to do a story on the University of Wisconsin, and they needed somebody to do some sketches for the thing. And they first asked Aaron Borod to do these drawings, and he said he was busy and recommended me. But it probably didn't hurt that I had met Russell Lines, the editor of these things, before in New York, and he may have remembered me from that. Anyway, I thought, man, this is a tough assignment. So I got up on a Sunday morning and went down to the Union and took a brush and some ink with me and drew the whole thing, the tableau of 20 or 30 desks, 15 or 20 people, and 15 or 20 windows, and all this stuff, just sketched off the... I was kind of surprised that I could do that well, off the cuff. I thought, wow, maybe I can draw after all. My teacher, my head of department at the Iowa, when I left there, told me I couldn't draw, so I was sort of glad that I could do this piece. And I sent it in. I do a lot of other stuff around the campus, too, including a drawing of Science Hall with a capital and Bascom Hall, which is quite famous in the university, and some other things around. But what I liked most was I did a drawing of the 602 Club where the artists hung out. And I did this drawing, and they actually, I sent about 8 drawings, of which they used 4 or 5. And I was perfectly delighted because they printed the one about the 602 Club. I loved it. And subsequently, the proprietor of the 602 Club, Dudley Howe, said to me, "I hear you did this drawing here in Harper's." He said, "What happened to the original?" And I said, "They sent it back to me. I've got it." And he said, "Well, what do they pay for something like that?" And I said, "About $75, which was a lie because they got the whole bit for $200. And he said, "Gee," he said, "that's a lot of money." And he went up to the other end of the bar to fool around and clean some glasses. And he came back and he said, "We've got to strike a bargain here. I'd like to have that drawing." And I said, "Well, Dudley, let's put it this way. Do you have a bottle of Jim Beam?" And he said, "Yes, I have one." And in fact, he said, "I have 2. So he gave me the 2 bottles, and the drawing was his. And I was still up there in the back of the bar. So it was kind of strange because I had an evening class. Took the 2 bottles to class and said, "Well, we're going to have a good time tonight anyway." Along about 1956, I was spending some time with K.U. Smith, Carl Smith, of the psychology department. What he really had in mind was to do a book on psychology, and he wanted to employ an artist to do some of the artwork for it. And he was picking on me. I didn't know it yet, but because we were doing a lot of fishing in Lake Mendota, he was kind of getting ready to suggest it. And he finally did. And he had done some drawings of his own to suggest some of the problems of psychology to Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, who were going to publish it. And they were absolutely undecipherable. They were crazy scribbles. I still got them, and I don't know what Holt and company thought about him, but they went ahead with it anyway and signed him to do the book, which he did with his brother in Princeton. And I should add, with the aid of his wife, who really wrote the book. But anyway, KU got this contract, and he said, take a semester off, I'll pay you your salary, and you can work for me doing this thing. Well, as a result of this, he had so much work to do that I never slaved for anybody as I did for K.U. Smith and his brother. I worked about 14 hours a day on this stuff, and then hired some other workers to help with these illustrations. And among them was Nancy Ekholm Burkert, who is now one of the renowned illustrators in the whole world. She can name her own project and her own price, for that matter, still living in Milwaukee. And so I worked not only through the semester, the second semester, about 1957 or so, but also through the summer. And it was a dreadful proposition to get all these plates done. And I did all the chapter headings, and a good many illustrations as well, and hired four or five artists to do the others, including Nancy, which is her first job, I think, out of college. Then she went on fast. But at the end of this time, I didn't realize it, but KU was rather a controversial figure in terms of psychology around the country. I didn't know this at the time. I was too ignorant to know this. But I didn't know, for example, that this thing was not going to last very long. As a generous stint, he cut me in for 5% of the royalties. And what this amounted to was a one spring check for $500, and the thing didn't last more than a year and a half or so. It went straight downhill, and that's the last I seen of this so-called royalty. And I don't know, I never talked to Carl about it, but and I didn't know why his views were not widely accepted. It seems that he was a behavioral scientist, and it's for some reason this book was simply not going to last. But the thing was, it taught me a lesson, and that was, if I was going to work for anybody ever again that hard, it was going to be for me. And that is exactly what I did. Meanwhile, I was trying to exhibit as widely as I could, which was a terrible lot of work. If you wanted to send paintings somewhere, you first had to get them framed, either to make the frames yourself, which I knew how to do, since I had done this as a student at Iowa, and I could make frames of any sort, but it took time. And if you paid for them, the payment was out of this realm. You had to pay very heavily to get a thing framed. And so that was a nuisance. But then, if you wanted to send a painting someplace, to Illinois or Denver or to Washington, D.C., you had to make a crate for it. And after you made the crate for it, or had it made, then you had to take it to the freight depot and get it sent. And when it was returned, you had to go and get it from the freight depot. And the chances were that the glass, if it was framed in glass, would be broken. And so this went on for years and years and years. And it was just the sheer drudgery of this thing made it impossible. I just hated it. And in spite of the fact that I had shows in Milwaukee and in Chicago, the whole thing, when you added it all up, was not exactly a financial success. You could work at a rate at full speed and full energy for a whole year and win a lot of prizes here and there and send out all these pictures, and about all you would get out of it for this huge amount of work entailed was about the maximum of about $2,000 a year. And it simply wasn't worth it. And, you know, since at that time I've learned that guys in New York spend half of their time selling their artwork, half the time working, and half the time looking around to get rid of it. And the prospect was appalling. It simply didn't seem to me to be any way to get ahead in the world. And I simply stopped doing it. And I started writing instead. And began modestly with a book on design for the extension department. And then got signed up to do a book called Elements of Design for Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston in New York. One of their traveling salesmen, Dan Wheeler, had seen me here, and he suggested that I sign a contract with him to do this book on design. And it took a long time to do it, several years of spending hours and hours in the basement of libraries looking through old tomes that had been discarded. And they've got a file down the basement of Memorial Library, which is full of this stuff. There's no place to be because it was like being in a jail. And you could see in spring you could see the blossoms coming out, and it was hard to go down there and spend hours looking through these old tomes for something you could use in this book. And it was really a hard thing to do, but I went through the thing, and I was kind of stubborn about it and determined that I would do it. And I was supported one day, you know, on the side of these files, down in the basement of the Memorial Library, they have cards on the ends of their lines of books. And I finally, one day, I saw one that was just electrifying. It said on it, "Cutter Crap." And I thought, My God, can this be true? Is there such a thing as that? And so I just stopped what I was doing, grabbed the thing out of its holder, and went upstairs to get it copied. And so there I met in the library itself, in this room where I went to have this thing reproduced, I found a very obese lady who was going to argue about it. And she said, well, that has got to be 10 cents. I said, it couldn't possibly be 10 cents. It belongs to the library. I didn't bring it in here. Nevertheless, she said, it isn't a periodical. And this went on for some time. It's a wonder that I give a damn about all the stuff it cost, because the thing was so funny that all I wanted to do was get out of there and go to the 602 Club where I might get a laugh out of it. So I finally said, well, all right, I'm going to pay you this sum, but tomorrow Lou Kaplan is going to hear about it. He was the head of the library. So I paid the thing and left and went over to this thing and showed it to a great number of people who enjoyed it very much. And it turned out that this obese, sweating lady was knocking down this department in the Memorial Library for $50,000 a year. God knows how she got away with it, but she was presently arrested and put in jail. And I thought, my God, this is weird, you know. Everybody around here is incompetent. Is the library hiring a person who is stealing this much money from them? And they don't even know it. But I was very happy considering her attitude towards me. I was very happy she ended up in jail. But there was nothing else that was very funny about getting ready to do this book, which was just pure sweat for about 2.5 or 3 years. And but finally, about 1960, I got it done. But as a result of all this labor, I finally got the manuscript and artwork to Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston. I never had so much trouble in my life as the editor, whose name is Charles Madison. We never seemed to get on the same page, as they say. He thought at the beginning that I was doing a book for home economics. And I had never seen a home economics room or teacher or anything like it. And we never saw eye to eye on any subject. He seemed to me to be some leftover of the last century, where you would do an agriculture book with two photographs of a sick cow. And I never got any favorable comment from him, whatever. It seemed to me he never understood anything about what design had gotten to up to that date. He was about 100 years before the Bauhaus or anything like it. He knew nothing about art, and it was a hard go all the way, and the correspondence shows it. A constant quarrel or sub-quarrel between the two of us to try to get the other one to understand what was talking about. I knew that there was a market for a design book because there wasn't any good ones. And he didn't seem to know anything about the bad ones either. And this went on and on. And I just didn't pay any attention to Charles Madison and went ahead with my own ideas. And they didn't have a great deal of confidence in the book as a result of Charles Madison's efforts in that hierarchy of Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston. Anyway, the company reneged on almost every promise that they had made. They promised to furnish some 5 or 6 illustrations with full color. And I was going to get them from Skira, which plates cost $500 a piece. And they said, no, we're not going to pay that for these things. You may use 5 colored, full color illustrations of books that we have already published. I said, hell, I'm not interested in the books you published because they stink anyway. And this was just one of the things that I couldn't put up with. I decided that in the end that I would pay the $500 a crack for these colored illustrations, and they reneged in every other way possible. And in the editorial thing was already difficult enough, but do the illustrations, of which there were about 225 perhaps, they reneged on every possible way, so that in the end, they had promised in the contract to publish it in hardcover and then propose not to. They said they were going to do it in a paper cover. So I was fed up. I went to a local lawyer named Dick Calloway, who has recently become appointed a judge. In these days, around 1960, he owned a bar. And when he was asked what he did, he said, drinking, which was the truth. I think I picked the right guy because I didn't want anyone to go to someone who would have the judgment to talk me out of it, which any sensible person would have, because Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston was owned by CBS. And what chance would a hick author be doing to stand up to CBS, their giant enterprise? I didn't give a damn. I said to Calloway, make out some papers to cease and desist publishing this document, this element to design, until they live up to their contract, which he did. He signed up the papers, he made the papers out, sent them to Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston. And I said to Calloway, stay off the phone. I'm going to stay off the phone for 2 weeks. I'm not going to talk to any of these sons of bitches. And we'll just wait it out and see what happens. My wife was in tears. I said to her, "Are you married to a mouse or a man?" Anyway, we waited it out and finally got a call from a vice president. And he said, "I'm so sorry to hear about this quarrel in our family of authors." This guy was supposed to do the stuff, and he had it in trouble, and he was supposed to get me to, he was to put oil on troubled waters, and he used that phrase, "the family of authors," which was hardly the case with a family of nothing. And so I said to this man, this was after staying off the phone, I finally got a letter from him too. And he said, "Well, I hate to see this happen in this family of authors, and we'll see if we can resolve this." And I said, "You read the contract, didn't you?" "Yeah," he said, "you got us. But I want to tell you something. If you get it printed in hardcover, you'll see that the students use the same book for about 10 years. But if you use a paper cover, they will buy the book every semester." I said, "Why the hell didn't you tell me that in the first place?" And he said, "Well, I'm sorry that this happened. I guess we just have some miscommunication." And he said, "What can we do for you?" I said, "You can go and publish the thing and give me 50 copies in hardcover, and you can do the rest the own way." He said, "Okay, we'll do it." So they published the thing, and then they did make 50 hardcover copies. They weren't done well. They were printed very badly, as I thought perhaps they would. And so that was the end of that. But they had so little faith in the book that they printed it short and was gone within a couple of months. And I was getting telephone calls and letters from people all over saying, "Where is this book? Where can I get this book?" And it was very irritating because I was mad at Holt all over again. I was boiling mad, but the fact was it actually worked in favor of the book because it built up a very considerable demand for it. So when they had to wait, the publisher has to wait their turn to get on a press that will do a lot of books. And it may take them a few months to get back in line. They can't just jump in because of stuff that got ahead of them. So when they finally got the book published, there was a big rush for it. And it immediately sold exceedingly well. And I found out about it on a trip back from Europe. We arrived there in the spring of 1961, I think it was. There were some guys from the department there, Italo Scanga and Warrington Colescott and one or two others. So it was a marvelous time to have fun. We just got off this boat and ran into these guys. And so I went up to Holt, Reinhardt, and Winston, met this same vice president. And he said to me, "It is time to figure out the spring sales. And if you like, I'll go downstairs and find out what the check should be. I said, okay. We went downstairs, and he said, well, this spring is $5,000. I thought, holy mother, this is unheard of. And I thanked him, and we left. And then we really celebrated.